The grace, mercy, and peace of the triune God be with you all. I begin with a question. What metaphor would best describe the last week and a half for you? Wilderness? Lost at sea in a huge storm? A quiet week at Lake Wobegon? Nightmare? Wake-up call? Over 30 years ago, George Lakoff and Mark Johnson wrote a groundbreaking study on how metaphors shape the way that we think and how they set our expectations for the future. Metaphors, they mold not only what we say, but they also shape the very way that we see things. Take the word argument. Argument. Have you been in any arguments lately? The metaphor we most commonly use to describe argument is war. Think about it. In arguments, you have winners and losers. Your argument gets what? Shot down. Your criticisms were on target. We use strategies. We attack positions. It's war. Now imagine what would happen, Johnson and Lakoff say, if instead of war, the metaphor was dance. Argument as dance. We're performers. And the idea is to achieve something balanced and beautiful. We take turns. We move together. We embrace. We release. We switch partners, we flow, and if you dance with me, well, you might have to endure someone stepping on your toes with really big shoes and looking a little awkward, because there's just nothing quite like big, tall, gawky people with long arms dancing, right? But we keep dancing, we keep moving. I'm sharing this example with you partly because I know that many of you are headed off to holiday gatherings with family members who are on opposing sides. Or maybe you're not going at all and really feeling kind of guilty or regretting it in some ways. And there has been fighting in your family. I know this because pastors know everything. And people have been hurt, and lines have been drawn, and communications are down. If argument is war, there are casualties, correct? And I'm wondering, what would happen if we switched metaphors, even for a few minutes? Argument as dance. Of course, you need a willing partner, and in some families that may not work, right? But maybe some of you will try it and report back from the hinterlands. I am a terrible dancer, but I'm going to give it a whirl. The other reason we're talking about metaphors this morning, or I'm talking about metaphors, is this. The metaphors that we choose, the stories that sustain us, really make a huge difference. How we interpret and understand our experience in terms of the stories that we use to describe it really makes a difference. So we talked last week about the election, and I pushed the metaphor on you that maybe it's a wake-up call. That maybe of all the things that it is, maybe it's a fire alarm ringing in the night. Thomas Jefferson once used that image. Even though he had slaves, Jefferson said, "Slavery is a fire bell ringing in the night." He was right, wasn't he? It's a call to action. And so what better place, I thought, to find wisdom and hope for our time than to look at some of those sacred stories of calling from our scriptures. Now, I'll confess in my mind that when Lauren was reading the story this morning from Mark, I pictured something a little different than Jesus walking along the seashore, okay? I was picturing Jesus driving a Greyhound bus. And on the side of the bus, are you with me? On the side of the bus, there was a big white flag with red borders. And there was a big red maple leaf in the center, okay? And the door was open, and he was leaning out the door, and he was saying, "Drop your notes, Pastor John, and follow me, and bring your winter jacket." That's what I thought of. Jesus called his disciples while he was walking along the seashore, and the places that he lived and the places that he frequented, and that was the ancient way of teachers gathering students. But calling today, how does that work exactly? I mean, is there like an audible voice somewhere? I mean, you may be wondering why I'm even talking about calling this morning to a congregation that probably for the most part has given up on a supernatural, magical way of understanding God. And so it's not because I understand how this God calling us business happens. I bring it up because I've seen it happen. I've experienced it. So let's set aside for a moment the ways that we often think about calling and the ways that we talk about it in the church, that it's mainly about people who are called into full-time ministry like me and Heather and Pastor Lisa, which is great, but has basically snuffed out any sense that anyone else has a calling that's worth hearing about, because calling is about what? Pastors. All of this, of course, is completely ridiculous, because calling is not just about pastors. At University Church, your history honors the calling of lay people. When I first came here, you told me that ministries began not at the behest of the senior pastor and the staff, but where two or three people gather together and have an idea that they want to pursue. Amen? Is that still true today at University Church? I think it is. Open Door and so many other ministries that we've started began with a few people who said, "Let's do this. Let's meet this need." Several months ago, I talked with a young woman in our church who was experiencing a calling to some really challenging work. And the whole thing seemed kind of crazy to her because she was raised in the church and she had all those same ideas that we had. You know, you hear a voice out loud, really? Seriously? I mean, I'm not hearing voices. And she'd grown up thinking a calling from God was that it was for ministers. So she felt completely left out, like, well, I guess there's not really a calling for me. Until she embarked on a four-year-long journey that began with an ache in her heart and that opened into what she now says can only be described as a call from God. What confirmed it for her was that she's usually skeptical about these kinds of things. She is usually bringing up every counter-argument about how this couldn't be, but she felt in this work that she was doing what was absolutely the right path for her. And even though there were folks in her family and her friends who had anxiety and worry about this new work of hers, she felt God's presence and love the whole way. We may not believe anymore in a God who is up there somewhere directing traffic, but that doesn't mean that we can't affirm a God who is right here with us, immersed in the life of creation, working through and with each one of us. When you sense that nudge towards someone who's hurting, I mean, when you're drawn toward reading and studying about something, when a certain topic maybe just keeps appearing everywhere you turn, it just might be the indwelling Spirit of God nudging you where you need to be. How do you tell that it's the Spirit of God, though, and not the pizza that you ate last night, right? That's the question. How do you tell it's not some other spirit? I mean, so here's some wisdom on calling from one of my favorite authors, Frederick Buechner. He writes, "There are all kinds of voices calling you to all different kinds of work, and the problem is to find out which is the voice of God rather than of society or the superego or self-interest. By and large, a good rule for finding out is this. The kind of work God usually calls you to is the kind of work, A, that you need most to do, and B, that the world needs most to be done. It's those two things together. Buechner continues, "The place God calls you to is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet." I love that. Where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. Sometimes our calling and our vocation line up. You're able to do all day what you most love and what the world most needs, and you actually get paid for it. But it doesn't always work that way for all of us. For some of us, we find that deep sense of calling and gladness in our avocations, in our work in the church or in other organizations, and what we do outside of our work, and that's okay. There are also times for all of us when God needs us in the moment. God needs our attention. God needs us to step into the breach right now, to speak out a word of love and compassion right now, to be with those who are vulnerable right now. And it all sounds great when we're sitting here in church and we're thinking, yep, I'm going to do that. Pastor John, sign me up. But then we get home and we check a few emails and we look at the news and we may get cold feet. My friend Ted Wardlaw, the president of Austin Presbyterian Seminary, he tells a story about going to seminary himself. It was the late 60s. He thought he was called to ministry, and no sooner had he unpacked his bags at Union than he began having second thoughts. He didn't like the food. He didn't like the people that he was around. He didn't like the weather. He didn't like the classes. And so he shared his doubts with some of his colleagues. This was, remember, the late 60s, early 70s. This was the high holy days of Rogerian therapy, Carl Rogers client-centered therapy. You with me? And so he'd say, "I'm thinking about leaving." And his friends would respond, "So you're thinking about leaving." Just reflecting things. And this was absolutely no help to him at all. So he made an appointment to speak with his advisor, the distinguished but curmudgeonly theologian John Leith. "I'm thinking about leaving seminary, Dr. Leith," he said. "Skip it," came the blunt reply. That's kind of how Dr. Leith talked. "But Dr. Leith, I'm not really happy here." "Skip it, Mr. Wardlaw. A great theologian once said that there is an SOB in every life, and right now, you're the SOB in your life. Skip it. Go to the library, read, eat right, get a good night's sleep, and then get back to work." That was his advice. This was the late 60s, okay? This is what we had for counseling. So Ted went off to the library and to the rest of his life and to his vocation. You know, sometimes we need smelling salts, right, to awaken us. We need those jarring words that the gift and the calling resides in us, and it just needs to be awakened and affirmed. We don't have to quit our jobs necessarily. We don't have to go back to school, all of us, or head off to seminary. We just need to listen in those moments and take a deep breath and pray for courage and respond. Okay, so circling back now to the story in Mark chapter 1. You know, there's an odd phrase in that story. I don't know if you picked up on it. Jesus said, "I will make you fishers of people." Does that kind of make you squirm a little bit in your seat when you hear that one? Yeah, because we don't know what that verse means, right? I mean, we're liberals. We have no idea what it would mean to be fishers of people. That verse has been co-opted by right-wing evangelicals to mean that we need to go out there and we need to convert everybody to Jesus and bring them all into the church. But when you dig deeper, those words, fishing for people, that's not what the verse meant. It doesn't mean going out there and dragging people in and converting them. Several prophets in the Old Testament, and Jesus was in that prophetic tradition, used the metaphor of fishing to talk about what God will do with those who are in power, who are hurting the poor. Imagine that, taking a statement of Jesus and then setting it in its prophetic context to understand that. Are y'all with me on this? Okay. Yeah, so the prophet Amos said this: "The time is surely coming upon you who oppress the poor and crush the needy, when they will take you away with hooks, even the last of you with fish hooks." That's the image that he's after. Are you following me? Amos 4, verses 1 and following. Fisher folk around the Sea of Galilee were directly under the thumb of the empire. They were taxed on everything. They were in debt up to their mainsails. They were the poorest of the poor. And so for these fishermen to leave their work to something else, it was sort of like, what do you have to lose? I mean, don't you love this? I just came upon this last week. It's from Ched Myers. And so Jesus is calling these fishermen to join him and to catch the big fish, the ones who are oppressing the poor and who are crushing the needy, to be about forming a community that's going to be different than the community all around them, that Roman Empire. And so when we respond to the call of Jesus, guess what? We're saying that we too are willing to go out there and we're going to hook some big fish. Like, we're going to stand up in our boats and we are going to reel in racism and bigotry and misogyny and religious intolerance, and then we will be about restoring kindness and compassion and honesty back into the center of our common life. Amen? Amen. That's what Jesus is talking about. And ultimately, will that save some souls? Oh, you bet. You bet. I've been moved by so many stories that I've heard from all of you in response to the election and that I've seen on social media. Stories where folks are not cocooning. Some of us are a little bit, but we're also reaching out. We're finding ways to take a stand, to make a difference. Joining the Southern Poverty Law Center, one of my favorite organizations, the NAACP, the ACLU, greeting Muslim worshipers. Some of you were over there at the mosque on Friday afternoon. Helping host Muslim and Mormon students who came here, about 125, 30 students last week at the church. Volunteering to work with refugees, calling your representative on the phone. Or just reeling in hate by doing simple acts of kindness, like this. So last week, one of our students was getting a Starbucks at the drive-thru, and she'd been talking with her group about where do we go from here, and they kind of resolved together that they would do random acts of kindness, that in light of all of the awful things that they were seeing, that they would try to inject some kindness back into the world. And so she decided while she was in line that she would pay for the person behind her in line. Then she noticed a tag on the mirror with a little stick figure holding a gun. The license plate, she noticed next, was 2nd AMNDT, Second Amendment. Are you with me? Okay, I'm not making this stuff up, okay? Linda read my sermon yesterday and she said, "Did that really happen?" And like, what do you think? I just like make stuff up on Sunday morning, like make stories up? Or, I mean, this happened. This happened, right? Yeah, this happened. Heather told me this story. It wasn't Heather. It was one of our students. So she gets to the window and she's still kind of like, I guess, like gritting her teeth, like, gosh, I need to do this. I need to do this. And she's determined to pay for this order. And then the cashier says to her, "Are you sure that you want to pay for the car behind you? Their total is $26. And at this point, she was quite sure that God was poking fun at her and having a pretty good laugh, mind you. But she followed through and she paid for the person behind her. I mean, I don't know how all of this works. I don't know the mechanics or the theology or the ontology of this, of these calls that we experience from outside and beyond to do these difficult things, but you know what? I know it's true because I see it happen in my own life and in yours. Jesus still calls us o'er the tumult of our life's wild, restless sea. And my prayer today is so simple that we will listen and that we will respond. Because in that call, we will find joy. We will find deep gladness, and perhaps we will even find a bit of laughter. God knows we need all of it right now. Amen.